This is Molly Smith, host of From the Median. It is my pleasure to introduce to you Dan Becker, President of Georgia Right to Life and National Field Director for Personhood USA. His topic is Roe versus Wade Overturned, when we recognize we are persons from the moment of conception.
And Star, I'm not married. It is a privilege to be here with you today. They've given me the spot right after lunch, and I promise you we're going to get taking off here in a second. You'll have to fasten your seat belts. There's information that's going to be provided over here on this screen, so if you can't access the screen or see it well, that's where a lot of the visuals are going to be. And as you can tell from my accent, the longer I talk, I am below the Mason-Dixon line. I can't talk as fast as David Barton, and I'm not going to try. That wouldn't be pretty. I am from Ohio. I was born in Marietta, Ohio, and it's good to be back home where my family is. So if you're from Marietta, come see me after the presentation today. We are dealing, if I could go ahead and get on, yeah, here we go. We have changed the title somewhat. We've got a return to first principles in the 21st century public policy debate. We are going to talk about Roe v. Wade. We're going to talk about personhood. We'll give you some history. In fact, we're going to take you back in a time machine about 100 years, century. Take you through a little historical vignette, bring you into the future, and then hopefully deposit you back in the present with a clear purpose and direction. Now, how many of you have been out to our table and our exhibit and signed the petition? If you have not done that, this is something that we would ask you to do to help shape public policy and the debate here in the state of Ohio. It's currently active in a number of states across the nation. North Dakota will be voting in November of this year on a personhood amendment and a change to their constitution that declares a right to life that must be recognized and defended. 19 simple, short, easy to understand words, and the voters of North Dakota may in fact be the first to actually ratify a right to life in the state constitution. So be sure and be following that. This is something you see all the time, but not in Georgia. This is unusual for Georgia. This is my front yard. 5 minutes before I went to the airport to catch a flight for Alaska, where the jonquils were blooming. Okay, so we're seeing some unusual weather patterns, and I had to drive across my pasture in my four-wheel drive to access the county road to get to the airport. There's some other things going on in Georgia. Unusual things, politically, pro-life. We're the only state in the nation that has all 9 of our constitutional officers pro-life, without exception. We're one of 2 states in the nation that can make the claim that there are no exceptions in our Georgia code. We don't save 98% and then explain why we regrettably cannot save the 2. We save 100% of the children in Georgia through our legal protection, and that is as a result of changes we made way back in the year 2000. We did what was called a millennial audit. You know how a factory that was around in the 1890s was retooled in the 20th century? And then again in the 21st, we believe the pro-life movement needs an audit. We need to examine what we've done, what works, what doesn't, and move forward with a 21st century young at heart approach that will capture the next generation hearts and minds. And we have successfully implemented that beginning in the year 2000 in Georgia. At that time, we'd been in existence 28 years. And we had not a single pro-life law. Last year, in 2013, we were awarded by AUL one of three states in the nation's All-Star State Awards. We are listed as one of the most protective states in the nation for the life issue. How do you get from no pro-life law, where 3% of your legislature is pro-life by definition in the year 2000, to today where 68% of our Georgia Senate, all of our statewide constitutional officers, are in fact pro-life without exception? Well, there's a determinative plan to achieve that. We don't believe that we're a deep South state. How many of you have relatives that have moved to Atlanta or somewhere in Georgia? Nobody in Atlanta is a native Atlantan. We're a cosmopolitan state, and that's where the votes are. So we've been able to take an issue, change public opinion, shift public opinion in our favor. And 3 years ago, we had a statewide election that was non-binding, where a supermajority of Georgians said yes to life being recognized and protected at its earliest biological beginning. We believe we're in it for the long haul. And I'm going to share with you a few of the things that I think we need to engage as we move forward in the 21st century. Gentlemen, I'm having a problem with the clicker. There we go. One thing I want you to take away from this meeting is ideas have consequences. If you can just simply remember that as the theme of this talk. And I'm going to show you what drives my passion. These are 23 of my 26 grandchildren. A lot of grandmothers in the audience. And they're growing. Time is passing, and what we do here today will affect their generation. We need to be certain that we're on the right track. I've been accused, or not accused, I'm asked all the time, you are Catholic, aren't you? And I said, well, I'm Southern Baptist, and that's not bad for a Southern Baptist, is it? I mean, we have the highest honor, my wife and I. She's with the Lord 8 years ago, but our children reflected and honor the one thing that we stood for, and that is children are a blessing. Children are a blessing. You know, the root of abortion is in the church when we don't accept that children are a blessing. These ideas were first presented to me in 2005. And, gentlemen, we're going to have problems with this. By Nigel Cameron. How many of you know who the Wilberforce Forum is? Think tank. Chuck Colson created the Wilberforce Forum, biblical worldview approach to public policy and debate. Nigel Cameron came to the 2005 National Right to Life Convention, and he said there are two things that are going to come to dominate public policy in the 21st century. Now, that's a pretty bold statement, but you could have heard a pin drop when he revealed what those two were, because nobody was prepared for what he said. Those two things that will dominate public policy in the 21st century are transhumanism and eugenics. We may have heard of eugenics, but I'm sure that first one is new to most. Same time period, Foreign Policy magazine identified transhumanism as one of the most dangerous ideas in the world. And Wired magazine, not a bastion of conservative thought, identified the somatic cell nuclear transfer cloning technology as one of the most dangerous ideas current. Dominating public policy. Now, what I want to show you today is that this is the reason we believe that the right to life movement, the sanctity of life movement, needs to be retooled for a 21st century approach. We are dealing with the redefinition of these two questions. When are we human? When are we a person? When do laws attach that protect all human life, innocent human life, from the moment of conception. We can't say that anymore. The word conception has been redefined by the liberal left. We have to say from our earliest biological beginning. Do you know that there are over 31 ways to create a human life? Over 31 different ways. NOVA has identified them. You can go to our website, personhood.net, and you can see the articles on the 31 different ways to create a human life. The bottom line there shows the elderly. They show instances in which personhood has been denied historically to a class of humans based on race, gender, disability, religion, age. These are all questions that are coming to the fore in our time right now. And we have been less than engaging as the Right to Life movement. I had the privilege, if you could call it that, of attending a symposium 8 weeks ago at Yale University called the Non-Human Personhood Symposium, and ended up having lunch with my friend, Peter Singer. I wanted to get past the man, the myth, to the man, and find out if he really believed the things that we accused him of. What Peter is doing is defining personhood in this way. And if you look him up on Wikipedia, the source of all human wisdom, you will find him listed as the number one living philosopher today. That is the claim that is made. And we're going to investigate why that's an issue here in the United States a little bit later in the presentation. Peter believes that the definition of personhood is someone or something, an animal like a great ape, a bonobo, chimpanzee, dolphin, elephant, that can feel pain, that has free will, that has the capacity to plan for the future, self-awareness, self-recognition, self-interest. These are all things that we would tend to agree with. But the problem is it leaves out certain classes of human life, those that are temporarily comatose, those who are in a persistent vegetative state, those who have some kind of progressive dementia, Alzheimer's, developmental disabilities. The preborn are not classified as persons under Peter Singer's definition, but neither are perfectly healthy children through 18 months. Perfectly healthy toddlers through 18 months do not meet the classification of his definition of personhood. What we're deciding in the 21st century and in the movement right now are public policy questions dealing with when are we human and when do laws attach that protect us as humans. Now, traditionally, the respect for the sanctity of life and human dignity has been a result of being based on a biblical foundation of truth, the Imago Dei teaching doctrine out of Genesis chapter 1. It's been supported throughout 2,000 years of church history, Western history. Do you know your pro-life history? We do a Pillars of Personhood training in Georgia in our churches, in our youth groups, that we take the next generation through these pillars and bolster their understanding and knowledge of how to engage the culture on these important questions. In the 20th century, we were anti-abortion. I say that because being pro-life is so much more broad. The sanctity of life question that the church has championed throughout history is so much more broad than just an anti-abortion approach. And in the 21st century, transhumanism and eugenics, if Nigel Cameron is correct, are going to be the battlegrounds that we need to engage on, as well as the abortion issue. Otherwise, we're going to see, as the foundation erodes on biblical truth, or one of the pillars collapse, the collapse in our culture of the culture of life. Ideas have consequences. All right, we're going to go back just briefly in time. About 90 years ago, to a place called Hadamar, Germany in the 1920s. No, that is not the ashes of concentration camp bodies, victims being burned. That is not what you're seeing. In fact, this is 11 years before Hitler rises to power, comes to power. In fact, he's in jail right now writing Mein Kampf. So this is socialist Germany immediately following World War I. And you know your history that Germany lost the war and the Allies put onerous reparations, penalties upon the German nation to pay back the damage that was done in World War I. That led to a hyperinflation where they're burning 1,000 mark notes to keep their houses warm, where they're wallpapering their walls or insulating their walls against the cold using billion mark notes. This is the famous picture of a wheelbarrow full of cash going to the grocery store to buy a loaf of bread. When you have hyperinflation of this nature and you have medical needs such as the young heroes of World War I who were recuperating in Hattemer Hospital had, you have a seemingly infinite amount of need with a finite amount of resources in a limited financial environment. What do? You have to have rationing. And so what they did, beginning in 1920, 11 years before the rise of Nazism, was that they went ahead and debated this in the public square. And they decided that the best minds of the day, that there was an economic savings that was justified by the killing of useless eaters. Think about that for a second. Who were these useless eaters? They were the hard cases. Any legislator will tell you that hard cases make bad law. That's an axiom in political legislative circles. But if you want to engage in cultural change, that's exactly what you emphasize, is the hard cases. And so beginning with Potter's syndrome, a deadly condition back in the 1920s, children born with anencephaly with no brain, just a lower cortex, trisomy 18, 16, 21, including Down syndrome, which were termed incompatible with life. These children were killed. But you know what the problem is with a slippery slope? It's slippery. And pretty soon it slid to the incurably ill, the medically futile, the mentally challenged, and then perfectly healthy, blind, deaf, and dumb children. And then it went to the half-breeds. And under Hitler, other undesirables through a eugenic plan, and then finally the Holocaust itself that we're all so familiar with. Over a 25-year period of time, Germany, under the assault of a neutered, silent church whose authority had been completely undermined by having no voice in the culture, it slid to where they were boarding up the windows of school buses, insulating their walls against the cries of the children as they pulled up to the apartment complexes and took those children for the best medical care that Germany could provide. That's what the parents were told, that we're going to give your child the best medical attention, socialized Germans, medical science can give you. They were taken to Hattemer Hospital, where up to, get a little closer here, 100 of these children arrived a day at the height. They were told to go in, disrobe, go for a medical examination, where they were assigned one of 60 fatal medical conditions, then tagged with a different color Band-Aid. One color said, go and take these children and kill them. The other said, kill them and remove their brains for medical research. And the third one was to break out their gold teeth if they had any kind of utility or value in their body. Now, this is called the T4 Actian program that was rampant in 1941, about 9 years after Hitler came to power. But you know what? They were burning the bodies of these children at Hanamere Hospital. That is what you see. And their ashes would arrive at the home of the parent along with a death certificate that said that their child had succumbed to one of these 60 fatal diseases, similar to acute appendicitis, which was particularly troubling to the parents whose children had had their appendix out 3 years before. You can't hide something like that forever. And even though the mighty power of Goebbels, Himmler, Hitler himself, the public outcry against the T4 Action Program had the parents marching in the street, and by 1941, Hitler had to shut the program down. Now, they were using these children for all kinds of heinous experimentations, scientific research, because they were expendable. They were unwanted in some cases, but morally justified. Point it up. Guys, there we go. You've probably heard the name Joseph Mengele. He's infamous as far as Auschwitz. He specialized in genetic research on identical twins. Joseph Mengele did what doctors at the time did in reverse. Most doctors would take Siamese twins who were conjoined at birth and separate them medically. He would take perfectly normal twins and conjoin them to see what the effect of was on their psychology, their physiology, their emotional state, and so forth. We won't go into the details, but I do want to point out that is Dr. Solomon, Jewish inmate at Auschwitz, who was required to aid Joseph Mengele in these heinous acts. And he had a rebellious streak in him that we'll see a little bit later in the presentation. But remember, Dr. Solomon, Jewish doctor, inmate. How many of you have heard of Godwin's Law? Anybody have a blog or know what a blog is? The blogosphere came about in the 21st century. Godwin is a gentleman who identified something that's true on the blog. The longer the blog and the debate between two people or two parties, the more likely it is that one party or the other is going to accuse their opponent of being Nazis or like Hitler. Okay? That's what Wikipedia, the source of all human wisdom, once again, says. The only problem with that is when it's actually true, when the comparison that is made is actually accurate. Now, I'm going to ask you, we're going to show you some headlines from today, and I'm going to ask you if you feel that they are, in fact, appropriate. Our first one is from Discover magazine just a couple years ago, May 2012. Now, Discover, the byline says, science, technology, and the future. And yet it's talking about human vivisection. You know, I saw David doing this last night. Boy, he was running through these slides, wasn't he? The editor of Discover magazine said that as much as they admire the medical profession, there is a rush to harvest human organs. The definition of brain death is being fudged in many cases. I say that firsthand knowledge. In the last 4 weeks, I've had two medical interventions in Georgia rescuing people from being harvested prematurely. And it was pointed out by the magazine itself, and the editor was let go for pointing it out. These are things that we're talking about as far as public policy today. Georgia Capitol, 2012, the pain-capable fetal pain ban, 20-week fetal pain ban. It was completely pristine. It was a principled, incremental approach. We are incrementalists in the personhood movement. We believe in incrementalism. We are not all or nothing. We just believe that you save 100% of everyone you set out to save. And in this particular bill, we did that. That is until it reached the Georgia Senate, where four senators, working with the Georgia Medical Association, decided to add an amendment to the bill that would define medical fetal pregnancies. The fetus is anencephalic, or a diagnosis of Potter's syndrome, or a congenital or chromosomal anomaly is made that's incompatible with life. Recognize those words? I didn't. I didn't know where that was coming from. I stuck them in Google, and guess what popped up? U.S. Holocaust Memorial. Slippery slope. United States of America, state of Georgia, 2012. Same slippery slope that we saw in Germany in the 1920s being introduced in our state and your state. I'm sure it's doing the same thing. Here's the faces of some anencephalic children. I've held them in my arms. They didn't die on birth. They didn't die at birth. They've lived, and we've celebrated their first, their second, their third birthdays. They smile. They're a joy to be around. They deserve human dignity and respect, the image of God in man. This little girl, and I'm going to call her Rachel. She's perfectly healthy. Rachel is just hours old. Well, the scientists at Cornell University did something to Rachel that had never been done to a human. And they certainly experimented on her without her informed consent. They took a gene from an Australian jellyfish that glows in the dark, and they combined it with her early cellular makeup to see if future cellular division, generations of cellular division, would propagate the glow-in-the-dark gene. And it did. And in May 2008, Rachel became the first glow-in-the-dark human. She was killed at 14 days under the stem cell law, where you can grow up to 14 days and then you have to be destroyed. But they proved the concept of gene therapy, at least in some facets. We objected, and we said to the National Institute of Health, look, this is wrong. And a spokesperson for the National Institute of Health said, this would not be classified as gene therapy in need of federal review because a test tube embryo is not considered a person. Personhood is when laws attach that government recognizes the humanity of the life within. And that is what personhood as a movement, as a goal and objective. And by the way, your own Jack Wilkie, friend of mine, Jack Wilkie, back in the early 70s, wrote a book called Love Them Both. And on page 3, he identified the goal of the pro-life movement. The goal of the pro-life movement is a human life amendment at a federal level recognizing the personhood of the preborn. And then on page 4, he says if that's not achievable at a federal level, then we need to try it at a state level. Well, it was never tried until Georgia came along in 2007 and became the first state in 30 years to attempt to approach the subject along those lines. Melissa Perry, MSNBC, when does life begin? I submit that the answer depends an awful lot on the feeling of the parents, a powerful feeling, but not science. Do you know that if you're 20 years old or younger, everything is based on feeling? Everything in today's public policy debate is how you feel about an issue. There are no absolutes. There are no standards, as David was talking about last night, duties and responsibilities before God and man. And here's my friend Peter again. He says if the parents want the newborn, it's wrong to kill the baby because the act deprives them of happiness. On the other hand, killing a defective newborn up to 28 days after birth is not the moral equivalent to killing a person. Why is that important? Because President Obama has appointed him the advocate, defender, and promoter of the Independent Payment Advisory Board over Obamacare, a 15-member panel that decides who gets paid for what. They determine who will receive treatment and what will be paid for that treatment. And let's say you have a life-threatening condition. You walk in, but you don't meet Peter Singer's criteria for personhood. You can't spend your own money to save yourself under the Obama plan because they won't accept your money. Any doctor under Peter Singer's advisory board that accepts your money is removed from the system, and that's how they control who receives and who doesn't. I sat down with him, and I confirmed that a utilitarian philosophy of government is in play through the Obamacare that is intended to ration medical care, the greatest good for the greatest number. Under that kind of system, rationing will take place and denial of service will be commonplace throughout. And I said, are you not afraid that this will cause us to go down that same slippery slope that we've seen in history? And he said, we're doing it already. This just simply codifies it into law and makes it official. I'm telling you, we are in for a public policy battle and debate of extraordinary mean. Personhood is what it's all about. What do they all have in common? Elizabeth Williams, just last year, said, so what if abortion ends life? The fetus is indeed a life worth sacrificing. Here's the complicated reality in which we all live. All life is not equal. I want to tell you, in 41 years and worth of activity and service in the pro-life movement, going back to 1973 when I studied with Francis Schaeffer, Dr. Francis Schaeffer at Labrie, Switzerland, I have never been as chills running up and down my spine when I read this quote. This turns a corner in the public policy debate to say that, yes, it's a child. Yes, it's a life. But all lives are not equal. I'm telling you, if this lie is allowed to stand, we will see sooner than later the slippery slope because obviously they all have the same commonality. They believe that all life is not equal, and that is particularly demonstrated through the post-birth abortion that they advocate. Now, I'm going to say this, and I don't want to be misunderstood. It's going to sound heretical to many. We, historically in the church, have been a sanctity of life movement. We saw the church create the first non-ambulatory hospitals, the first adoption agencies. We saw the church rescue children abandoned to wild animals outside the walls of Rome. We have been against abortion since on record from 90 A.D., the Didache, you shall not put a child to death by abortion, nor shall you kill a child that's already been born. Infanticide and abortion from 90 A.D. We are not just about saving babies. I mean, it sells well. It is what I've been about for most of my adult life. But it cannot be the only thing that we focus on in the 21st century. We have got to expand our sights to embrace the full counsel of God and His Word and His ways. And that includes defending the Imago Dei wherever it is attacked. End-of-life issues have got to take more and more of a prominence because under Obamacare and the baby boomers entering that time of their life, we're going to see more and more assaults on human dignity and the sanctity of life in that arena. We call this the personhood principle. The doctrine of Imago Dei, expressed in the culture through our political action, through our legislation, through our hopes and dreams of a overturn of Roe v. Wade. You know, it was Justice Harry Blackmun back in 1973 who wrote the majority opinion in Roe. And he said, if the suggestion of personhood for the preborn is established, the abortion rights case, of course, collapses, for the fetus's right to life is then guaranteed specifically by the 14th Amendment. He admitted that the entire debate in Roe v. Wade was over the issue of the personhood of the preborn. Now, I'm going to take you quickly, and we're going to as quickly as my clicker will allow. If we're working to overturn Roe, and we woke up tomorrow and it was done, it was finished, we have outlawed abortion completely. Is the pro-life movement finished? Is it? What are we going to do with the elderly who are increasingly under Peter Singer's plan being labeled post-persons? You know, we've actually had that ruling in the Georgia Supreme Court in the last 3 years. Post-persons. It's all about personhood. When law is attached. What about the pre-persons? Do you know that headlines yesterday, how many of you saw it? 1.2% of all live births in America today were created in a test tube. 1.2% of all live births are through in vitro fertilization technique and infertility treatment today. The problem with that is it creates a surplus of human lives, sometimes as many as 20 to 1. And what do you do with all these surplus humans? You freeze them. Shelf life of 200 years, according to the scientists. The record is 20 years right now. An embryo that was thawed in the early or late 90s, brought out, and their twin brother was graduating from college as they were being born. We have no disposition for a frozen embryo at the current time. And they are being increasingly stored in liquid nitrogen and put in a state of suspended animation. Are they these lives that have been created in the image of God? Is this something that we should be concerned about? Should we have public policy debates? You think the abortion crowd and lobby is tough? We tried to outlaw this in Georgia, and we just had the pharmaceutical companies, the medical companies, the doctors, and the Board of Regents who were doing research on these surplus embryos. This is the number one source of human research right now in, you know, human experimentation without informed consent. Human-animal hybrids, that's a subject that we'll take a look at in a minute. Most of you are not even familiar with the subject. The good beginning of designer children through genetic testing and the weeding of unwanted children, and, of course, the duty to die of a good death, which is what euthanasia represents. We are not asking government to define personhood. As David pointed out so well last night, government cannot be trusted with the definition of personhood. It's an inalienable right given to us by God that we are asking government to recognize. This is the exercise of personhood today. Historically, the government has not gotten it right. In 1787, when our Constitution was created, blacks were defined as only 3/5 of all other persons. Now, we know that that was for representation in Congress, but they introduced a concept, an idea that has a consequence. That idea is that there are classes of life that do not deserve the same and equal protection under the law. And 80 years later, in Dred Scott, blacks were judged to be a subordinate and inferior class of being. And 1 year later, the Virginia Supreme Court said, in the eyes of the law, so far certainly as civil rights and relations are concerned, the slave is not a person, but a thing. Now, I have a caution sign here. Ideas have consequences, and we're going to show you a graphic image of where this idea of blacks being not a person, not protected by law, recognized by law, but a thing. So you can turn away, and I'll be off in just a second. This is long after the Civil War, emancipation, and the granting of civil rights. But we know from the Deep South and our own history that whole families were treated as things. And it took, what, the 1960s civil rights movement. It took a social movement of the people before the injustice was corrected in the hearts and minds of Americans across the board. If we were to reverse Roe v. Wade tomorrow, would it stick? Have we convinced, in your mind, 50% plus one of Ohioans where their duty lie? In 1876, the Canadian Supreme Court says, women are persons in matters of pains and penalties, but are not persons in matters of rights and privileges. How do you like that, ladies? Well, that didn't sit well with Emily Murphy. Emily became the first elected member, female member of Parliament in the British Empire. And when she went to be seated, the Prime Minister said to her, Emily, I can't seat you. And she said, why not? He said, well, you're not a person. And she said, we'll see about that. She went to the Canadian Supreme Court. She asked the Canadian Supreme Court, does the word persons include female persons? And the court's response was, no, it does not. What do we know happened next? Marching in the streets, a civil rights movement, a movement of the people, an outcry that led to the overthrow of that position in public policy. It's not uncommon. Have we won in the court of public opinion? Ideas have consequences, and it's still being worked out in other countries of the world, where in China, India, Asian countries, 100 million baby girls have been killed based on their gender alone. When we tried to outlaw this in Georgia, we were successful in coerced abortion, in gender-based abortion, but when we added the number one cause of abortion in Georgia, which is race-based abortion, our own pro-life politicians said that was a step too far. We've got a long way to go before we are able to claim that we have succeeded in changing public opinion. Native Americans, an Indian is not a person within the meaning of the Constitution. Congress may prevent an Indian from leaving the reservation, and while he is on the reservation, may deprive him of his liberty, his property, his life. This is in 1881, and that's by 1890, that's exactly what they did to a peaceful Indian tribe that had invited the U.S. Cavalry to escort them to a safe haven immediately following the massacre at the Little Bighorn, General George Custer. They were asking for protection, and what they got was retribution. The helpless children and women were chased as far as 2 miles from the original scene of the encounter and cut down without mercy. And, of course, we know what happened in Germany when Jews were no longer even considered human. And it's always the women and the children who seem to suffer. Greg Cunningham says this disturbing pattern of disputing someone's humanity to weaken his claims to rights of personhood repeats itself again and again in Western culture and history. The dehumanization through the denial of personhood leads to genocide, one way or the other. We're going to move now into the future in the few minutes that we have left. And Chuck Colson pointed this out better than anybody else I know. He coined this famous saying when he said, we move from the taking of life in the 20th century through abortion, euthanasia, to the making of life through in vitro fertilization and some of the 30 other ways that it's being done, to the faking of life, using some of the emerging technologies to invade that realm that has been so sacrosanct. Thomas Glessner wrote a book called The Emerging Brave New World. He's over many of the pregnancy resource centers here in the United States, a leading figure in the pregnancy resource movement. What in the world is he doing writing a book of this nature? He sees the emerging public policy debate that the right to life movement that affects women, children, the preborn across the board are going to have if we don't engage. The two terms again were transhumanism and eugenics. And to me, this is one of the most blasphemous areas of public policy today, man creating man in man's image. You can't have anything more blasphemous than that. It's intentional. It's direct. It's the use of new sciences and technologies to create a post-human race. That's their intent. Their symbol is H+, and the name of the species they wish to supplant our species with is Homo perfectus. If you have smartphones, young people, all you have to do is put in H+, and up will come the magazines and the publications and everything leading the public policy debate. Do you know that this symposium, non-human personhood symposium at Yale, we had the top leading transhumanists from the rest of the nation, Princeton, Harvard, they were all there. There is a cohesion among the leftist agenda to promote a philosophy. Remember what David said last night? That the seed of philosophy is planted and the structure of the tree produces the fruit that it bears. But it all comes down to the philosophy. Well, transhumanism is the leading philosophy of the day. And it's using these very good emerging technologies. We're not Luddites. There's nothing wrong with the science behind the transhumanist philosophy, because it doesn't belong to transhumanism. It's a genuine advancement of the human condition through medical knowledge. But it's being corrupted by a philosophy that is directing it down a certain path. For instance, artificial intelligence. How many of you enjoy your smartphones? Well, do you remember, how many of you here remember when you had to carry your cell phone in a suitcase like a computer tote bag? I mean, that's going way back. Technology advances. And what you're looking at here is history in the making. In December of last year, BINA came as the first invited artificial intelligence to a college symposium at Yale to present a question and answer time to the audience. In other words, fully interactive. She spoke to the group. She answered questions. She memorized your faces and names. She has facial recognition software. She has voice recognition software. The attempt here, as they stated, is to download your consciousness into an avatar so that you can live forever through your avatar. Eternal life through an avatar. But they believe that it's going to be more than an avatar at some point. Now, you know, Bina is a real person. Her husband, Martin, created Sirius satellite radio, Sirius XM satellite radio, and they're using their billions to promote a transhumanist agenda through our universities and public think tanks today. Now, Mr. Martin decided he was no longer Martin, but Martine, had a sex change, and now Bina is married to a wife named Martine, and they are involved in the transhumanist. I mean, I don't even know where to call her, an it, or how to refer to the couple themselves these days. You think Facebook is confused on gender identity. Well, these are people you all know and recognize, three generations of evangelists for transhumanism. Three generations of Americans have been evangelized. Wait a minute. What do we call these guys? Super heroes. Yeah. Yeah. It's an evangelistic tool to promote transhumanism to my grandchildren who are buying it hook, line, and sinker. The enhancement of the human body, the three on the right are external enhancements. The four on the left are transgenetic enhancements that take place at a biological level. And it's nothing more than a lie of Genesis chapter 3, where the serpent said to Eve, "You will not surely die." Do you know that immortality is the objective of transhumanism? Sinful man trying to live forever is their objective. It's their stated objective. Can you imagine Stalin still alive with us today? God, in his mercy, has given us a limit of 120 years on evil. Otherwise, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. If evil does not get removed from the earth at a set limit, then it will consolidate its power to the haves and the have-nots, and this immortality will be parceled out to those in an oligarchy that develops over time. We are seeing a shift in public opinion that has to have the pro-life movement engaged. We will be like God with an increase in knowledge through mind-computer interfaces. You know, it's not science fiction. You go to Radio Shack, pick up a device for $100 that fits over your head, and you can direct the cursor on your smartphone with the thoughts that you think. Now, they're guiding wheelchairs for quadriplegics through thought processes and so forth. These are all advancements, but it's not as out there as you think. Ever heard of ectogenesis or an ectogenic womb? It's an external womb, an artificial womb. Cornell University claims that they're about 5 years away from developing a womb capable of supporting human life. Why is that important? Because the feminist movement is uncertain how they're going to respond when a medical procedure no more invasive than abortion goes in and removes the embryo growing inside of the woman, granting her under Roe v. Wade a right to privacy. And then the state, under the viability ruling, has a responsibility, a duty to protect that human life. It's already being acknowledged. What are we going to do when you can take a human child out of a woman who does not want to be pregnant? Scientifically, it's coming. Well, the feminists have answered the question. They've decided that they do not want their genetic material walking the earth. It's a blob of tissue, and it belongs to them. Kill it. And that is the public policy on this. This is Cornell's artificial womb being used to grow a headless mouse. This is from a Time magazine article recently. Organs intact, legs, tail. What's the purpose of it? Well, obviously it's to grow organs so that you can harvest these organs for other sick mice. No, it's so that you can apply this technology in a farming sense, PHARMING, and have a ready source of organs for transplant. Now, these are not make-believe. You have spider goats in Pennsylvania, whole herds of them, where transgenetically they've been combined together so that the protein in the milk is extracted in the form of the spider web and spun into a silk thread 100 times stronger than steel. It's being used in Kevlar vests and other government issue defense contracts and that kind of thing. It's current today. And of course, the fluorescent green pigs were the technology used before they tried it on Rachel to produce a glow-in-the-dark human. Now, this is an artist's rendition of our human future. It's somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but this is happening today. These are not real pictures of what we call a cowboy in the UK. That's what the press calls them. They're 98% human, 2% cow. They're created by killing a small child who's been left over through infertility treatment, taking the nucleus of that child from its mitochondrial material provided by the mother, which kills it. It is then taken over to a cow egg that's been denucleated and inserted and then zapped with electricity, and it begins growing again. It's 98%, according to David Prentice of the Family Research Council, 98% human, 2% genetic material of a cow. Why is that important? Because cosmetic companies, drug companies need human test subjects. And if you want to get around the moral concern of experimenting on humans without informed consent, then you use a 98%, 2% chimera, human-animal chimera. It's been going on in UK for 8 years. We tried to outlaw this in Georgia, and University of Georgia, Emory University, Georgia Tech, all came out against it because it's central to their current research and development in areas today. Eugenics, and we'll quickly go through this. How many of you saw the headlines 2 days ago of the gene therapy that was done to correct a genetic defect in a child by adding a third person's DNA genes to the child, creating for all time a cure for a particular condition? It's called germline intervention, and the UN is debating outlawing it. It's so dangerous. This is the danger that Wired Magazine said. Once you make a change to the human genome, there's no putting the genie back in the bottle. That change can be reproduced sexually generation after generation. And we don't know what the unintended consequences are because we don't understand the technology well enough now to know what we're doing. When you combine human-animal hybrids, you create a bridge vector for diseases that's unnatural in nature, but is being done now. We have public policy issues that are out there that Wesley Smith says we're 15 years behind as a pro-life movement in discussing. You know how the internet was developed? Driven by the engine of pornography. That was the financial engine that created the internet. Well, it's the gay and lesbian lobby that is providing much of the political capital for cloning. Why? Because they're looking for ways to genetically reproduce their partner and their DNA combined together. And you can do that now by taking a skin cell from one partner through adult pluripotent stem cell technology, reprogramming it to become a female sperm, impregnating their partner's egg in normal IVF procedure, and then implanting it in a surrogate, third woman, to carry to term, paid for by a fourth, proving what Hillary Clinton said, that it takes a village to raise a child. But it's four women claiming maternity rights to that child legally. And it's being done in California as we speak. Hasn't reached the stage where any children have been brought to birth yet because the technology isn't quite there. And this last one, and we'll close in it, and it's the perfect race. And, of course, that can never happen here. It's what Hitler sought. And sure enough, only high-quality embryos are selected for cryopreservation. Since poor-quality embryos seldom survive the freezing and thawing process, this is from the website, Emory University Reproductive Center. Let's change one word here. Only high-quality children are selected for cryopreservation. I mean, that's what it is. Let's face it. Let's not cover over with euphemisms. Children are being produced in excess, and they're being treated as property. And this is something that we as the pro-life movement should be involved in and should be concerned with. Transhumanist magazine asked a German transhumanist, is there any interest in eugenics in Germany now, or is it a totally taboo subject? Due to the Nazi history of Germany, eugenics is actually a totally taboo subject here, regardless of the differences in definition, goals, or means. And then it goes on to say that human enhancement technologies, these are also viewed in the same context. Why? Because history is understood. God's judgment has fallen upon the nation of Germany twice in two generations. And it is clear that there is a direct link in their mind between these heinous practices and what God allowed in the way of travesty being visited on their country. Do we have school buses appearing today? Metaphorically, I'd say that we do. Are we seeing rationing that leads to killing? Peter Singer says it's already here. It's just a matter of codifying it and recognizing it and putting it into a little clearer practice. Is our culture collapsing? Not. If we and the next generation of young people coming along engage in this important area and issue. It's all dealing with personhood. When do laws attach? When do we see protections given under the law? And I'm going to close with that same quote that you saw from David last night. Thomas Jefferson, "Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his judgment cannot sleep forever." Remember I told you about Dr. Solomon in Auschwitz? If I can get there, I'm going to show you the rest of the story. There is a gentleman in Florida that came up to me after this presentation, and he said, "You know, both my parents were survivors of Auschwitz. You have to get this message out of the slippery slope. We're seeing it happen, and my family experienced it firsthand." His name was Saul Pinchon. Some of you may know him. He's in the head of 243 pregnancy resource centers in the state of Florida. He is an amazing guy. They are saving thousands of lives. And yet he had this story where his mother, Germaine, was one of the women in Joseph Mengele's heinous practice of medical experimentation, where they removed her ovaries, her reproductive organs, to see what the effect would have on her genetically and through hormone treatment and so forth. Well, Dr. Solomon was observing and helping Joseph Mengele during the operation, and Mengele had already removed one of the ovaries when the air raid siren went off, and Mengele hightailed it to the bomb shelter along with all the other Germans, leaving instructions with Dr. Solomon to sew her up after he had removed her second ovary. Well, that rebellious streak kicked in, and what he did was he bent over, whispered in her ear, and said, "Name your first son after me." And that is what she did. And she named him Solomon Pinchon. And at 40 years of age, he met his Messiah, Jesus. He led his mother to his father to the Lord before he died, and he asked us to pray for his mother to come to Christ, who is with us today. This is Germaine, and this is
her firstborn son, Solomon. Solomon Saul Pinchon. The family will rejoice and increase even more with the arrival of two more great-grandchildren as Saul's daughter welcomes twin girls in November. Because of Germaine's horrible ordeal, Saul's very birth is a miracle in itself. But because of Saul's commitment and the commitment of so many other caring people, miracles are happening every day. Because we are called for such a time as this, today's Holocaust of abortion is being replaced by miracles of life. One day at a time, one life at a time. Thank you for helping us to fight the Holocaust of abortion in our community.
Government recognition of personhood and protecting all innocent human life. And I would be glad to take questions after it's over. You've been very patient. This is a difficult one. It's one that, you remember David last night said you have to be a watchman on the wall? You have to shout the warning. Well, that's what I do. Going around, encouraging the Right to Life movement to embrace a fuller, more complete approach to the sanctity of life. And I want to tell you that based in Georgia, it works. Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Dan Becker, President of Georgia Right to Life and National Field Director for Personhood USA, and 2014 Bringing America Back to Life Symposium speaker. This presentation was brought to you by Cleveland Right to Life, where through prayer, action, voting, and education, we are bringing America back to life.